My name is Bill Chadwick, and tonight I'd like to share with you some impressions from a trip that I took to the Soviet Union in the middle of last month, June of 1984. I'm not an expert on the Soviet Union. I've had some classes, I've done a lot of reading, and I've been there for 2 weeks, and that's what I can share with you. How many of you have been to the Soviet Union? Okay, there are some people that can catch me. The trip that I was a part of was sponsored by the National Council of Churches of Christ of the United States. National Council of Churches and the Russian or Soviet churches have been sponsoring exchanges since 1956. The pace has picked up a little bit recently. There were a group of 19 church leaders from the Soviet Union that traveled through the United States in May of this year. Four of them were in the Twin Cities. I had a chance to meet them and then saw one of the gentlemen again in the Soviet Union when we were there in June. There were 266 of us, which was the largest group of American Christians ever to visit the Soviet Union. We were divided into 10 travel groups within the Soviet Union so that we weren't this whole mass of people all the time. I want to say just a few introductory remarks and then show some slides and I want to deal with some. What I hope to do tonight is give you some general facts about the Soviet Union, and then give you about 12 slides of travelogue, which will give you a quick idea of the places, the four cities that our small travel group visited, and then deal with the church in the Soviet Union, with peacemaking, with human rights, and then have time for general questions and comments at the end. And I would expect we'd be out of here within an hour. First of all, a thing that is, I think, important is, in spite of the title of this session, which was From Russia with Love, that's just a play on the James Bond movie by the same title. The correct name of the country is the Soviet Union, or the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. Russia is merely one of the 15 republics or states that make up the Soviet Union. It is by far the largest and most prominent, but nevertheless, you do not want to call the Ukrainians Russians. That would be like calling people from Minnesota Texans or something like that. I mean, hey, it's all the same. We know that. That's just something to be aware of and to watch Dan Rather and all the other big-name news people make the mistake all the time, and people in government on both parties calling those people the Russians and the country Russia. Incorrect. The Soviet Union is a massive country, about 2.5 times the area of the United States, has just slightly more people than we do, about 275 million. We have 225 or 30 million. Soviet Union is, which was really new to me, is very, very far north. It's equivalent of Canada and Alaska. Only 3% of the Soviet Union is south of Minneapolis, which means we were there in June and the days were very long. It didn't get dark till after 11 in Moscow. It didn't get dark at all in Leningrad, which is the same latitude as Anchorage, Alaska. Some other just, you know, sort of trivia things for Trivial Pursuit freaks. There are only 3 cars for every 100 people in the Soviet Union, whereas we have 50 for every 100 in the United States, which is a real mixed blessing. Moscow is a very clean city, very quiet city, very little pollution because of the lack of traffic. It was very nice. The transit system is very good throughout the country. The prices for transit, mass transit, are the same as in the 20s. It costs the equivalent of 7 cents to ride the subway all day. I mean, as much as you want, Subways are very, very fast, very efficient. Bus is 7 cents also. The trolley is 5 cents and that sort of thing. So you can see you don't need a car, especially a new car would cost a typical worker about 2 to 3 years' salary, and you can't borrow money to do it. You got to pay cash. So not many people own cars. So, and maybe I'll think of some more of these. But let's get have a look at this amazing country, which is full of contradictions, as is probably any country, even Norway. Could someone hit the lights, please? I don't think I can do that with this magic board here. Thank you. As any slideshow with Soviet Union begins with a picture of St. Basil's Cathedral, is that in focus for you folks? Okay. Near Red Square. Red Square, by the way, red in Russian language means not only color red, but also beautiful. And I think really in English that this square would be better translated beautiful square. It was named hundreds of years ago. Does not refer to red as in communist. Okay. I'm sorry about this slide, and I won't apologize for very many of them. That all may be one was the theme of our visit, that we may express the oneness that we have in Jesus Christ. Our primary mission was to meet with Christians in the Soviet Union. The lettering at the top is in Russian, that all may be one. There are many, many parts of the Soviet Union that are very modern. This was our hotel that we stayed in Moscow, the Cosmos Hotel. Had, I think, 1,700 rooms, was very nice. Had swimming pool, bowling alley, all sorts of things like that. Though I would say the craftsmanship was not what we would experience in the United States. Many, many visitors to the Soviet Union from all over the world. We saw lots of people, especially from East Germany, and then, of course, the Eastern Bloc countries, some from Australia, a few other groups of Americans, peace groups, Quakers, and I think people like that. This picture of the subway, very, very clean, very, very efficient. In many of the subway stops in Moscow, they have artwork or stained glass windows, sculpture, things like that. They have no drunks sleeping in the subway, which is a mixed blessing, perhaps. We can talk about that later. This is across, this is also in Moscow. The tower on the left is the is a television tower, which has a revolving restaurant there, and the monument on the right is to their space program. Moscow. And here in the window of a building is an abacus, part of the contrast. Many, many of the shops where we would have little calculators, they use abacuses or whatever the plural is. Abacus. Abacai, I don't... but it was really amazing. In fancy hotels, in the gift shops in the hotels, they'd be using abacuses, those things. We saw quite a few skateboarders. Now, this is the only real touristy shot I'm going to give you. This woman in the blonde hair was our tour guide, very intelligent, really knew her stuff, spoke excellent English. This was part of our small travel group of 26 of us. This man looking at the ascension of Jesus Christ here to the right of her is... the Reverend Samuel Athanasius, who is the Archbishop of the Syrian Orthodox Church for Canada and the United States, based in New York City. He was, in the 40s, Bishop of the Syrian Orthodox Church in Jerusalem, and when the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, they were brought to him. He was the reigning clergy person there, and he accompanied the Dead Sea Scrolls to the United States and has a fascinating story to tell about that. Very justly very proud of his role in the discovery and taking care of the Dead Sea Scrolls. There are statues of Lenin everywhere. There are no longer statues of Stalin anywhere, except we were told in Georgia. We visited the Republic of Georgia, which was Stalin's home republic. We did not happen to see any statues of Stalin there, but Lenin is omnipresent. That's where he really is right now, and that's Lenin's tomb. Those of you who've had Greek in seminary can probably read the Russians very close to Greek, Lenin. A friend of mine, also a Presbyterian pastor, she and I went on the subways one night, and we could find our way around the subways because the Russian language is so close to the Greek, and our seminary Greek finally paid off. Red Square, about 11 o'clock at night. Again, Red Square, late at night. Signs like this, sort of go get 'em, guys, make this a bigger and better country, very prevalent throughout the cities. It's a group of young pioneers explained to us that they're similar to our Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts. Depends on which story you hear as to how much indoctrination they get or how much it's just sort of physical education and other education. But these were people that were, this was inside the Kremlin grounds, and they were evidently here as from another part of the Soviet Union and just tourists within their country. This young man sitting there is trying to resist the efforts of these young Soviet men who want to buy his jeans. There's a saying that I don't know, maybe you'll think this is funny. I didn't, but other people did. The Soviets are angry with the West for bringing in to their country three things that begin with D, the three D's: drugs, jeans, and jazz. I didn't like it either. This was very rare. This was right outside one of the restaurants in which we ate. You simply do not see advertising type things like this. You know, no Happy Chefs and Burger Kings. And I mean, this is high class, but this was very rare, this Happy Bear here. We started in Moscow. The whole 266 of us were there several days, and then went off in our small groups of 26 or 27. We flew Aeroflot, our group, down to Armenia, which is right on the border with Turkey. And this picture was taken, however, in the Vienna airport, because the one place that we were not allowed to take photographs was in the airport, any of the airports that we were in. No photos. Otherwise, we were free to take them unless somebody said not to, and no one ever said not to. We took pictures of soldiers, and we took pictures of all kinds of things without anyone bothering us. The experience on Aeroflot helped me to become a stronger capitalist than I am already. I can see problems with both systems, but certainly Aeroflot could use some competition. It is the national airline, the only one in the Soviet Union. We had, in our first flight, there were about 120 of us on this plane that was equivalent to a DC-9. There was one flight attendant, and in a three-hour flight, we saw her twice. As far as we know, she was flying the plane as well. There are no assigned seats. You just sort of crush on and hope you're the first ones in. There's no food served on their flights inside the Soviet Union. There were about 20 young Armenian men on this our first flight that had bird cages full of parakeets, which didn't fit anywhere under the seat or in the overhead compartment. So they were stacked in the aisles and in front of the lavatory. You didn't want to use that lavatory anyhow, but it was really amazing. And then there were no safety announcements or safety cards. And just before we landed, this tiny little Armenian woman got out of her seat and stood in the aisle and held onto her seat as her chair as we landed. She thought that standing up would be a better idea in case something happened. She could get out in a hurry. It was really quite amazing, and I thought, boy, give me good old USA competition here. Because if I had any choice, I'd take any other airline. We flew to Yerevan, the capital of Armenia, a city of 1 million people. I had never heard of it before my trip. I was very embarrassed about that. But very Middle Eastern. The people are very dark-haired, dark-complected. Lenin Square. There's a Lenin Square in every major city in the Soviet Union, I believe. And if you look up in the upper left, you see something that looks like Mount Rainier. And that's in Turkey. Anyone know what mountain that is? Mount Ararat. And Noah's Ark supposedly came to rest on Mount Ararat. We visited an Armenian Orthodox seminary that had a piece of the Noah's Ark in it. That was impressive. From Yerevan, we took the bus through the three, maybe there are four, someone could correct me here, but the what are called the Caucasian republics, Armenia, and then we went through Uzbekistan just a short little ways and into Georgia. Is there a fourth Caucasian republic, anybody know? Okay, it won't be in the final. And we took the bus and we came to this Lake Sevan, very beautiful lake. It's sort of a resort area. And we ate lunch at this magnificent restaurant with a five-course meal with all sorts of different wine and champagne and caviar and, you know, four forks I didn't know what to do with and all that stuff. And then the restrooms, were really incredible for the men and women both, I was told. Just a place to put your feet and then a hole and no toilet paper. And you didn't need to be able to read the sign because you could smell when you're getting close to the restroom. So just an amazing type of contrast that this restaurant was just four-star and the bathroom was right out of the Boundary Waters. The bus trip through these roads was very exciting. And having come from Moscow a few days later, we were driving across the Caucasian republics and several times had to wait for cattle or for sheep to get off the highway. Very, very Middle Eastern down here in this part of the country. This is Tbilisi, the capital of Georgia, also a city of 1 million people. This is about where my lens started to give me problems with my camera. We were hosted in every city by various religious leaders, and this is a fairly typical banquet that we had. It was not your typical Lutheran potluck. And I don't normally drink, but we had lots of toasts and things. And anyhow, I'm back on the wagon. But it was trouble there for a while. The hats that you see that a few of the men wearing are typical Georgian hats that are worn both winter and summer. They're made of wool and supposedly warm in winter and cool in summer. All the men in our group were given them by the archpriest there facing away from you in the gray hair on the left. And I forget what else I was going to say about that. Okay, now we move from there to Leningrad. This is the Hermitage. It used to be the Winter Palace of the Tsar where the revolution began in 1917, storming of this palace. Here's Leningrad. After midnight, that should be a song, shouldn't it? Leningrad after midnight. This is the Bay of Finland. Right across there, just not too far, you can see Finland. This is the hotel we stayed in. That shot also was taken close to 1 o'clock in the morning. We were scheduled morning till night, but we were free to pull out of the schedule and to go where we wanted and talk to who we wanted, and I'm quite confident they didn't have 266 KGB agents following, you know, one on each of us. This is a group of young men that that my roommate and I mean young people, that my roommate and I met. My roommate was the black fella on the left there, and he got me into all kinds of trouble I wouldn't have on my own. But the two men to our right of him, young men, spoke very excellent English, as did the woman to their right, and we spent a couple of evenings with them and had a good chance to talk about what life was like for them. We went up to one of the young men's apartments and traded some things, like shoes and running shoes and tape recorders for, they had a little lacquer box and Russian flags and things like that. Okay, now that's enough of the travelogue. Let's get into some meat here. This is a picture of, I brought my slides and I forgot to bring my notes with me. I apologize. This is a picture of a church in Leningrad. These are some churches inside the Kremlin in Moscow. And these three churches that I just showed you are today museums. They are not working churches. I think that's really sort of a handy designation for some of our churches in the United States, museums versus working churches. But these, sadly, are not churches being used. Let me just pause here for a minute and talk about the church in the Soviet Union. About 275 million people in the Soviet Union. The best estimate is that there are 40 to 60 million active Christians, worshiping Christians. The vast majority of those are Russian Orthodox, though the Armenian Republic has its own church, Armenian Orthodox Church, and Georgia has its own church, Georgian Orthodox. There are about 1 million Baptists, about 700,000 Lutherans, about 33 or 34 Presbyterians, maybe 100,000 Pentecostalists. Sometimes we get the impression that the Christians in the Soviet Union are all Pentecostals because of the press that they've gotten, the seven that were in the Soviet embassy and things, and that's really a that would be sort of like looking at the religious scene in the United States from the view of the Jehovah's Witnesses or one of the non-mainline groups. The Soviet Constitution, a new constitution in 1976, I believe, guarantees freedom of worship. And within a fair amount of truth, I mean, that is the case. Freedom of worship. Beyond that, the church is circumscribed quite a bit. A church, to be legal, needs to be registered with the government. All groups, whether it's bird-watching groups or churches, need to register with the government if they have 20 or more people and they intend to hold meetings. The vast, vast majority of churches do register. The vast majority even of Baptists do. I said there are about 100,000 Baptists. The estimates vary, but somewhere between 8,000 and... I'm sorry, not 100,000 Baptists, 1 million Baptists. The estimates vary on those who are unregistered, somewhere between 8,000 and 100,000. I know that's a big range, depends who you ask. Of the Baptists in the Soviet Union are unregistered. They feel that to register is to grant authority to the state that belongs to God. Thus, every time they meet, they are illegal. There are about 200 Baptists currently in prison in the Soviet Union for doing things that are not legal, primarily worshiping together or teaching their children in Sunday school. Worship is allowed. Programs of Christian education are not allowed. You can teach your children at home, but not the priest cannot have a gathering of young people or adults together to teach them doctrine. You're not allowed to have systematic programs of evangelism. They're not allowed to spend their money on really anything, not allowed to do mission work, as we would call it. And there happen not to be, as far as we can tell, too many poor people or people who we would say would need that type of mission taking care of physical needs in the Soviet Union, but they can spend their money only on care of the buildings and care of the priests. And if you've seen many Russian Orthodox priests, you can tell they're eating their keep or something. They're big men. And we can talk some more about this. Here we are on Pentecost Sunday, June 10th, at Zagorsk, Zagorsk, which is about an hour from Moscow. It is the spiritual center of the Russian Orthodox Church. It's about a 10-acre complex here with several churches, Russian Orthodox Seminary, and Pentecost is one of their two big festivals, especially associated with Zagorsk. There were that day between 8,000 and 10,000 pilgrims there from around the Soviet Union come to worship at Zagorsk. Our whole group of 266 came here and had a tour through there and were part of the Orthodox worship. In our group, we had a designated person to take photos inside churches during worship so that we weren't all clicking away. And I have not yet gotten my copies of those, so I'm sorry, so I don't have much inside churches, just a couple shots coming up here. Here's inside one of the churches inside Zagorsk. These are seminarians studying to be Orthodox priests. You can see they're still slender. They haven't made it very far in the church. And they, in the Orthodox Russian Orthodox Church, they do not use any instruments to accompany. They believe that the best instrument is the one made by God, the human voice. And they have choirs in all the churches. Many of the churches have choirs of both men's and women's voices. But here at the seminary, at a seminary choir, about 15 or 20 guys were all that were here still. It was summer vacation. And they sang a few songs for us, and I mean, they sounded like the Mormon Tabernacle Choir amplified. They just are able to produce a tremendous sound. That's part of their training in seminary, is how to fill a massive cathedral by yourself when you're chanting. Very, very beautiful. Here's the ceiling of one of the rooms in there. Here's a picture of an iconostasis, which is sort of a wall that sort of keeps people away from the Holy of Holies, if you think back to Israelite liturgy. Row upon row of icons, there are only two rows here, but there are four or five, and one row will be pictures of the life of our Lord, and one will be saints of the church and martyrs and things like that. The trees down here are birch trees. Pentecost, it's typical that they bring inside the churches birches as a sign of new life, is how they explained it to us. I didn't really understand that too well. But all the churches, virtually every church we were in, and we were in dozens of them, are very ornate, very, very beautiful paintings and icons. Just magnificent, very sensual experience to be in Orthodox worship. There is incense, there are the paintings, as I mentioned, there's beautiful music, there are candles being lighted all the time by both clergy and especially by the lay folk, and you stand during worship, and the worship service will be anywhere from 2.5 to 4 hours. We only had to stand through a couple of them all the way. But believe me, I was all my aching back, Michelle Karpenko, after 3 hours of standing in worship, especially when you don't understand the language. But very, very beautiful. The churches that we were in were all full. Even the churches that we went to off the schedule, when just a few of us would pop in churches at different times. They would have worship not only Sunday morning, but each morning of the week and each evening of the week. Most of the people in worship would be, there's another church in Moscow, a smaller one, but inside it's just beautiful. Most of the people in worship look like this woman, Babushki. A babushka is a scarf, word in Russian, as many of us know, and because in church all the little grandmothers wear scarves, have head coverings, the generic name for grandmothers is now babushki. And probably 90% of the people in the Orthodox churches would be babushki. And Bruce Rigdon, who is a history professor at McCormick Seminary and was our leader on the trip, has been to the Soviet Union many, many times, I think maybe 20 times. He said the first time he went in the early 60s, he went to a worship service and afterwards went up to the priest and said, "Thank you very much for your service. It was very, very beautiful, very wonderful. I have a few questions." And one of the first questions he asked was, "What happens when the babushki die?" And the priest rolled his eyes heavenward and said, "Oh, you Americans never understand. Don't you see, the babushki never die." It's been the case throughout really Russian history since before the revolution. It's a tradition that most of the people in worship are the grandmothers and the little children. And the tradition is handed down from grandmother to granddaughter and grandson. And when women get to be grandmothers, they seem to suddenly find their place in the church. Most of the worshipers, not all, there were some young people, there were some men, most of the worshipers in the Orthodox churches, Armenian, Russian, and Georgian churches, were these little old women. At the moment, there doesn't seem to be a terrible price to pay for being a Christian, certainly not like it was during Stalin or Khrushchev. If you are a Christian, there is theoretically no, and I think to a large extent it's true, no discrimination in education, that you and your children may go to high school and on to university if you qualify. The Orthodox priest that traveled with us had four children that had all gone through the university. There is little discrimination in employment except teaching. They do not like to have teachers be Christians. And any job that requires you to be a member of the Communist Party, if you are a member of the Communist Party, you cannot be a member of the Christian Church. If you are a Christian, you cannot be a member of the Communist Party, which makes sense to me because each demands ultimate allegiance. And you cannot serve two masters, as we know. So for those few jobs, and they are the best jobs, of course, that require membership in the Communist Party, Christians cannot hold those jobs. There are only about 18 million Communist Party members in the Soviet Union, about a third as many as there are Christians. In addition, there are somewhere between 25 and 45 million Muslims in the Soviet Union. This is a church just a few minutes' walk from our hotel in Moscow, and the pastor of this church here is Father Arkady, and he traveled with our small group of 27 people the whole 12 days in the Soviet Union and spoke English very well. We grew to be very, very fond of him. That's his wife on our right, and the woman on the left is sort of the head nun for that church. There are three other pastors of that church. When you have worship twice a day and you have to stand up for 3 hours, you need to spread the load around a little bit. He spent 7 years in the United States as the representative of the Russian Orthodox Church to the United States, so he has very, very warm feelings to the United States, for the United States. So that's about churches, and you can... No, I don't want to leave churches yet. One thing. Oh, wait. No, I see what slide this is. I'm confused. This is a seminary in Leningrad. We had a short meeting there with long speeches. The four portraits up in the front that you see, there were four more on the other side, are portraits of various patriarchs of the Russian Orthodox Church, the equivalent of the Pope. And on the left, it's difficult to see, and I don't think I can get it really into focus. Can anyone figure out who that portrait is? That's, yes, Lenin. And that bothered me very much, to have a portrait of Lenin inside the seminary. The Russian Orthodox Church really has, in a sense, favored status within the country. They work fairly closely, the government and the church, and it's a confusing issue. It's something I haven't worked out myself. It's hard for me to be very critical. The patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church, Patriarch Piman, has spent somewhere between 5 and 8 years in jail during the Stalin years, and it is difficult for me to be very critical and say, well, you should be working yourself away from, out from under the thumb of the state a little bit more than you are. But it was a very sort of confusing thing for some of us to see how the state and the Russian Orthodox Church, not the other churches, work together more closely than I would desire myself. We visited a synagogue in Tbilisi. This is the main worship area in the synagogue. This is up on the second floor. It's difficult to see. It was quite dark. Up in the top there is a balcony, and the rabbi informed us that was standing room only, though you didn't have to stand all the time in the Jewish faith, each Sabbath. And he said that things really, really were not too bad. It's always hard to figure what he was free to say and what he was not free to say. In recent years, as many as 50,000 Jews per year emigrated from the Soviet Union. That's down to about 2,000 a year now. And that's an issue of concern for many of us, that not very many people are being allowed to emigrate. Those who do apply for emigration often wind up losing their jobs and having things really tough for them. And this doesn't come in focus, I'm sorry. These are the men greeting, or saying goodbye to us as we left the synagogue. The people were very, very friendly all the time. All the people we met in churches, out of churches, in synagogues, on the street, very, very friendly towards American people. Can you guess what kind of church this is? What denomination? Baptist, you've got it. It's a Baptist church in Leningrad. It's a church used by four different not in Leningrad, I'm sorry, in Tbilisi, the capital of Georgia, used by four different congregations, one that speaks Georgian, or two that speak Georgian, I think, one that speaks Russian, one that speaks Armenian. No, it's got to be four different languages. I'm sorry, I don't recall. But up on the Bible in front, it says God is love in the four different languages. This was not a worship service. We just came in one evening. The pastor visited with us. That's him on the left. That's our guide in the middle. My roommate on the right, who was also a Baptist from Georgia, different Georgia, Atlanta, Georgia. And in all the churches, in the synagogues, wherever we went, as a good Soviet custom is to give gifts. And we always received gifts. We always gave gifts. And here, my roommate Bill is giving the presentation of this gift. I don't recall what it was, but he also talked about how a group of 75 Baptist ministers meet every Monday for lunch, and always in their prayers, and as they pray as only Baptists can, they always pray for peace, and especially for our Christian sisters and brothers in the Soviet Union. It was a very, very moving speech. Another gift in another church. We had many homemade banners and things. I mean, banners made by churches in the United States that representatives then brought them and gave them as gifts to the churches there. It says, peace on the top, has all the doves, and down the bottom in Russian is written mir, which means peace. This is a church dating back to the building, dating back to the 700s in the Armenian Orthodox Church. Archbishop Samuel is all dressed up here. For visiting the churches. The Armenian Orthodox Church was the first national church in the world. 301 AD, 24 years before Constantine, I think, wasn't it 325 AD in the Roman Empire? So they're very, very proud of that fact, being the oldest national church in the world. About 90% of the Armenians are at least nominal Christians. Bruce Rigdon told about one time that he was in Armenia during on the day before Easter, and in the morning he had a meeting with one of the Communist Party officials and spent quite a bit of time with him, and that evening went to the Easter vigil in an Armenian Orthodox church, and he looked over and there was this Communist Party official, and he managed to make his way through the elbow-to-elbow crowd and said, "What are you doing here?" And the man said, "I am an Armenian. Where else would I be on Easter Eve?" That seems to contradict the fact that you can't be a Christian and a Communist Party official in Armenia. Really, when you get out of Russia, the Russian part of the Soviet Union, things are a little bit seem to be a little bit looser than in the European part of the country. This is a Bible from the 400s, has never been retouched. The green is from flowers, and the blue is from something that's in my notes, and the red, I remember, was made from the blood of worms. We were hosted by the second in command of the Armenian Orthodox Church here, and were served cognac and heaping mounds of cherries. And again, I kept thinking of potlucks and how that varied. This warm gentleman is a TASS photographer, and we had much coverage by the Soviet press. We're in print all the time. Of course, we couldn't read any of it, but our guide read it for us throughout many of the newspapers talking about our trip. And he was a photographer for the news agency TASS. I'm ready to leave talking about churches for a little while and deal with peacemaking. This is the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. And note the motto in the main hall, "Live and let live." We met with not Soviet Ambassador Hartman, but his deputy. I really apologize, I don't have my notes. Anyhow, he spoke for a short while. This was when we had the whole group of 266 of us together, and then we asked questions. And we asked many very, very difficult questions, and questions that were critical of U.S. foreign policy vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. And we really got very straight administration line, which of course was not surprising. The one admission that he did make was that he felt that the strong rhetoric that Reagan used early on was not helpful, and they've backed away from that. That was a mistake, and they're getting away from the evil empire sort of language, things like that. Many of the people in our group were very, I'd say, angry after this meeting, because we got just straight, all the fault is the fault of the Soviets, and everything we're doing is right. I felt some of that, but I also felt very lucky to be able to ask those questions, to be very critical openly of our foreign policy, because I cannot at all imagine people in the Soviet Union asking those questions. Most people in the Soviet Union, I don't think, really would even think of those questions, because they do not have the free press. And also the whole education system in the Soviet Union, really throughout the Orient, I think much of the Third World, does not teach people to be critical, but rather to embody the tradition and to fit into society, even if it's not a communist society. But it was a weird feeling. Anyhow, a straight party line, but I was glad for the chance to ask these hard questions. We met with Armenia, and this is the equivalent of the governor of the Republic of Armenia. And he spoke to us a short while and answered our questions. And here we got the straight party line from the Soviet point of view. We also met with many peace committees and friendship committees. Those are designed, as far as I can tell, to give at least lip service to the idea of peace and friendship. They insist that those are not government financed, that they're financed by workers and factories and things like that, and the people are volunteers that work for them. We met with many of them, and with all of those committees, we got, again, straight party line, that really all the fault of the arms race, the escalation of the arms race, the deterioration of detente is the fault of the Soviet Union. I mean, is the fault of the United States. On the wall of a building that we figured out was sort of an officer's club in Tbilisi were these political cartoons. And we saw these when a few of us were out walking one night, and I thought, well, I'm going to get back early in the morning, I'm going to take a picture of these. And when I got there, there were all these soldiers coming in and out, and there was a traffic policeman about 30 feet away from me, and I walked right by and thought, well, gee, Bill, you promised your mom you wouldn't get in trouble. But I came back a little while later and thought, what the heck, if they've got them here on the wall, they can't be ashamed of them. So I snapped a quick picture, and that's why it's not quite in focus, because it was very quick. And I got the heck out of there, my heart pounding. But you can, the upper left one, if you can't, I'll fiddle with this, but I don't think it's really going to get into focus. The upper left one is sort of Uncle Sam and Reagan put together there, and he's got these missiles, yokes of missiles on the heads of the European heads of state. The one on the right is Reagan as a cowboy, and he's rounding up all these people with missiles on their backs. And down the bottom, Europa is the word on the right. I don't know what it is on the left, but that we're putting in all these atomic weapons, nuclear weapons on Europe. It's really probably not anything terribly different than we would see in our newspapers, but the next day, you know, there'd be something critical of Chernenko or Tip O'Neill, or, you know, adversarial positions here. And it really bothered me to see this in the Soviet Union. It made me suddenly intensely nationalistic, and I felt, hey, it's one thing for me to be critical of our president, but something else for you folks to do this. It really made me feel kind of scared and sad. This is a monument in Leningrad for soldiers of World War II. World War II is like yesterday for the people of the Soviet Union. We got it everywhere. We got it from church people. We got it from people in the street. We got it from people in the friendship and peace committees. They lost between 20 and 25 million people, about 50 times as many as the United States. 1,400 cities and towns were destroyed. Leningrad had a population pre-war of 3 million. 600,000 people starved to death, 400,000 soldiers died at Leningrad, one-third of the population died in World War II. There literally is not a family in Leningrad that was not affected, that did not lose a person of their family by World War II. They're very, very proud that they really were the ones that broke the back of the Nazis. The siege of Leningrad was 900 days, as many of you know. But throughout the country, the people were very, very proud of their efforts in World War II, and determined to be safe, to be militarily secure. We placed roses on this war memorial, another, a different one in Leningrad. There was music playing here, very eerie, very moving music. We also visited a cemetery in Leningrad, which has 400,000 people buried in it that died during the war. Most of us do not take pictures. They're a very moving experience, really beyond comprehension to think of that many people just buried in mass graves. This strange statue was in the subway. Woman on the left with a submachine gun. People, as I said, want to be militarily secure, and they are willing to do, I'm convinced after having been there, willing to do anything, to make any sacrifice to be militarily secure. My impression is that anyone who thinks we can spend the Soviets into submission is absolutely bonkers. Americans are not willing to make one-tenth the sacrifice that the Soviets are ready to make or that are already making. They will do whatever it takes to keep up, in their view, with the United States. At the same time, the single most vivid impression that I have from the trip is the desire for peace. We got that from people in churches, from people in the official committees, everywhere, that they want peace. I can't speak for the government, but the people on the street don't care at all about world domination. They want to be left alone to live out their lives. We would go into churches and worship with people, and on the way out, it would sometimes take us half an hour to get out because people would embrace us, would grab our hands, and would over and over again say, "Mir, mir, mir, druzhba," peace, peace, friendship. Very, very moving. People just on the street, when they found out you're Americans, were very, very friendly. We had difficulty buying anything because they would give us whatever we were in line to buy. They are able, I think, much better than Americans, to make the distinction between the government's foreign policy and the people of the country. Whereas we think of the Russians, I think many of us, I know I used to, sort of an amorphous mass of these gray, humorless people, evil, sinister. Their attitude towards regular old Americans is just absolutely, for me it was just astounding, much, much more friendly than in any country I've ever visited around the world. The people are very anti-Reagan. They're afraid of him. There's strong things in the press against Reagan. In recent months, there have been three different references comparing Reagan to Hitler, and you can imagine the feelings they have towards Hitler, having lost 20-some million people. So that's scary. Could somebody hit the lights now, please? This is the final shot that I have here. When I was coming out of the... am I talking too loud or too softly? Okay. When I was coming out of the synagogue in Tbilisi, I was one of the last ones out and kind of hurrying, getting my camera together and stuff, and coming out, and this man, about 55 years old, caught me just as I came out the door, and he whopped me against the arm and... you know, startled me, and then he said, "Reagan, Reagan!" Boom! And he shadow punched and stomped, and it really caught me by surprise. And I said, "No! No, mir, mir, peace, peace." And he smiled and nodded, said, "Peace, peace." Reagan has caught their attention, at any rate, and people are really, really quite frightened. When we would raise questions, when we would raise questions about Soviet intervention in Afghanistan and Poland, which we did, I did personally as many times, and other people did too. We'd get real. Amazing answers about how that was the fault of the West, that, like, for instance, in Poland, we violated Polish laws by sending them publications and sending them machinery that were against the Polish laws for the West to send. And in Afghanistan, they said, well, the reason that we have to be in there, we have agreements with the Pakistani government. Eight times Pakistanis asked, I mean, Pakistani, Afghanistan government, eight times the Afghans invited us or asked us to come in and help them in their civil war, and we refused. And finally, we had to go in because so many soldiers were coming in from Afghanistan, from Pakistan, financed by the United States. So they, you know, saw the things that we were so critical of as the fault of the West. We didn't really buy that too well. But when we did talk about things in the arms race, they would make 3 points with us consistently. Even people in the street, they know what's going on, at least their side of the view. And the first was that the Soviets have offered a freeze, mutual nuclear weapons freeze, consistently since 1977. And it's the United States that has refused to go along with that. Secondly, it is the Reagan administration now that has made plans for anti-satellite and anti-missile things in outer space in violation of the ABM treaties that we already have, and the Star Wars theory. He has now offered to have talks on that in September or after the election, but that offer hadn't come in by the time we were there. So it's the freeze, the Star Wars concept, and the third thing was no first use. The Soviets have promised unilaterally, question of course is whether you can believe them or any government, but have promised not to be the first to use nuclear weapons. It is NATO policy in Europe to use tactical weapons, nuclear weapons, against the stronger conventional forces of the Soviet Union. So we are not willing to say we will not be the first to use nuclear weapons. But it was difficult to answer those three things, those three criticisms of the American point of American side of the arms race. The one thing I wanted, I've got just a couple notes here I wanted to make sure I got in somewhere. The one thing that the Russian Orthodox Church people would say when we'd ask them about their relationship with the Soviet government, they'd say, well, you know, we do what we can, and we don't worry about it too much because the church has been here for 1,000 years and the Soviet government only for 67 or whatever it is, and we'll be here for 1,000 years after the Soviet, you know, after the communist government is gone. So we're not worried too much about that. Okay, I've gone on longer than I intended. Questions or comments, or feel free to go if you're tired. The cost of the trip was about $2,700. There's more than likely going to be another trip next year, again sponsored by the National Council of Churches. And they do have some scholarship money available for that. I recently, in January, left the church that I've been serving for the last 6.5 years to do some independent study, and one of the things I was going to do was go to the Soviet Union. So they gave me a going-away gift, a financial gift that essentially amounted to half of my trip, and they said, we wanted to give you a one-way ticket to Moscow. Yes, thank you for reminding me that. I wanted to mention that. In the Baptist church, in a Baptist church, the whole 260 of us were gathered for a cantata that the choir director of that church had written. There were about 45 people between, I'd say, 18 and 40 that were the singers, a dozen instrumentalists, and they put on this beautiful cantata called Life and Peace. And it was a room, something like this, except the balcony was on, it's very much like this, balcony on three sides. Balcony was a little bit bigger. And we were down here, and the members of that Baptist congregation were up on top. And during one of the speeches afterwards, there were four banners that were unfurled, four different people strategically located around, rolled down banners written in English. One of them said there are 200 Baptists in prison now, and the number is increasing. Another one said Baptist pastors from Moscow, Kharkov, Tashkent, Leningrad and tens of other cities are in prison right now. One said, this is a persecuted church, and the other one I couldn't read from where I was and didn't ever get straight what that said. They were lettered very well in English. And when they dropped the banners down, we've learned later that people in the congregation who could not read the English thought that they were atheistic banners and propaganda from people who were demonstrating against the Christian church. And these people, these members of the Baptist church that were there, were very embarrassed and scuffled with them and got the banners away. They dropped the banners down to us. We talked with some of the people afterwards. These four people who did the demonstrating were unregistered Baptists. They were not members of that church. Their allegations, as far as we could tell, were true, as far as Amnesty International. Amnesty International has confirmed that there are 200 to 300 Baptists that are in prison. One of the women we were able to talk to afterwards, and they weren't whisked away immediately by KGB. We don't know what might have happened to them later, but at least at the time they were able to talk with us, and we had reporters on the trip that questioned them, and we questioned them. And one woman, I'd say early 20s, mid-20s, her husband was a Baptist pastor, was in jail. He'd been in jail for a while, been out for a short time, thrown back in jail because they continued to worship while they were unregistered. We asked them what probably would happen to them, and they said, the woman said, I don't think anything will happen to me, but I would guess that my husband will get harsher treatment in prison. So that's a matter that was very sobering, very sickening, I guess would maybe be a good word, and a matter that has certainly been in my prayers since then, and I hope will be in all of ours. Yes, a couple of the leaders of the group were embarrassed, I think, partially, that felt that it was an embarrassment to the host church there. And the vast majority of us in the group were really quite disgruntled with the leaders of the trip. And we talked about that at length in New York in our debriefing, and I think felt better afterwards, but it was confusion, and people had to be making some split decisions. Again, a million Baptists and 8,000 perhaps, or maybe 100,000 unregistered. So, it's been interesting to read the different news accounts and just to see how that came out. But there was, I'd say, the vast majority of the people on the trip were disgruntled with the two or three leaders who were embarrassed and who were, you know, making comments like that. Most of us were very sympathetic. Well, pretty much. Is that Compline or what's happening next? Oh, okay, I didn't know there was. Okay, we'll finish up here real quickly. At one of the seminaries, different small groups of us had different guides, and we had this young man, and he said, you know, the problem is we don't know, we, speaking of Americans and Soviets, don't know what our governments are doing. And I would agree with that to some extent. I think we know a lot more than they do. But he said, your government, he said, you don't know what your government is doing in Central America or, he listed someplace else. You don't know what your government is doing in Central America. And then he looked around and under his breath said, and we don't know what our government is doing in Afghanistan. I think we had varying amounts of knowledge of what was going on. The store situation was really better than what I had heard over the years. Certainly nothing like our stores, nothing at all. Things were not attractively displayed. Again, there's lack of competition. I mean, in one town, there's only going to be one kind of this store, and there's only going to be one kind of that. And so you don't need to worry about quotas, selling a lot of stuff. And quality would be inferior to ours almost without exception. There were not many long lines, occasionally, but not lots. I would rather live here, I guess, as far as consumer goods. When we got back to the United States, we came into New York. We had debriefing for a day, and our buses went right through Harlem. And that was very stark contrast. In the Soviet Union, economically, you do not have the wide range that you have in the United States. You don't have people sleeping in subways, and you don't have zillionaires. And I guess maybe that's the difference between a controlled, totally controlled economy and capitalism, where you either make it or don't. It's a mixed bag. Capitalism has been very good to me and most of us. Some people, it's not. But I would encourage you to go if you get a chance. What it did for me was it put faces on our enemies. And I have a real different feeling now when I think about all of our missiles aimed at the Soviet Union. Granted that theirs are aimed at us, but when I think of my friend Father Arkady and a young woman that I got to know named Lana, and our in-tourist guides that we got to be very warm with, it really makes, and plus all those thousands of Christians that we saw, devout Christians in the churches, our sisters and brothers in Christ, that we need to break down these walls somehow. And I'm not optimistic that the governments are going to do it. The quote that kept going through my mind was the quote from Eisenhower: the people want peace, and one of these days the governments are going to have to get out of the way and let them have it. So let's pray together. God, we are grateful that your church transcends all boundaries, and that as Christians, we, whatever country we're in, we call you Lord. Help us to be faithful. Help us to remember our sisters and brothers in the Soviet Union and other places that are not free. Help us to know what we can do to be, at least to be, diligent in prayer, and that, as we know, is a lot. In Christ's name, amen. Thank you.